My name is Mark Schwain, and this is a session called What's Wrong with Education? I'll be doing four of them this week, four different sessions, all of them having to do with education, though I hope each one will prove to be self-contained so that you don't have to feel like you need to come to all four. Just come to one, come to the first one, the third one, and so forth. They're not going to somehow build on each other so that you have to be at all four to get the picture. I tell you a little bit about myself and then how I want to work in the hour we have together. I've been teaching for over 20 years now in all kinds of different contexts, but mostly higher education, community colleges, large state universities, large private universities. Currently I'm at Valparaiso University in Indiana, where I'm the dean of a small interdisciplinary honors college. So I've had occasion to reflect on education from personal experience for some time, and my guess is that most of the folks in this room have also had occasion from various vantage points to reflect on the same subject. I think that one might begin by saying that the one thing we probably know about learning and teaching is that we don't know very much about learning and teaching. That is, in spite of vast industries devoted to the study of how people learn and what knowledge is and what kind of knowledge is most worth having, we still, it seems to me, know relatively little about those two crucial subjects, teaching and learning, which certainly are important in order to understand education. So I think that what I want to do is to invite us to think together and to talk together about this subject. And what I hope to do in the first half hour is simply to set out some terms and some ideas, a kind of vocabulary, which we can use then, I hope, to talk together about what's wrong with education. I suppose I should say at the outset that the title could be a little misleading. Someone pointed out to me that this was a kind of a typically Lutheran way to organize 4 days of discussion. I hadn't thought of this, actually. A former colleague of mine, Dion Lagerquist, pointed out that first there's the law, what's wrong with us, and then there's the gospel, what's the good news, etc. So we start out with what's wrong, implying somehow that education is itself a sin of some kind. What's wrong with it? Like, what's wrong with sex? What's wrong with education? Is it sinful? Well, no, that's not really the issue. Is education sinful? Is there something wrong with education? I think we would all agree that education, understood as a process of growth and development leading to human flourishing, is a good thing. But if we were to substitute what's wrong with schooling for what's wrong with education, we might be a little closer to what people probably had in mind. That is, when we get around to organizing in some kind of institutional way the whole process of education, do we have a sense, at whatever level of education that we're talking about or schooling that we're talking about, that there are some real difficulties facing this country and the world in the area of education? So let me just set out before us some preliminary observations on this question and then invite conversation. It seems to me that in order to think clearly about what might be wrong with schooling or institutional endeavors to educate, we need first to get clear on what we think education is, and clearer still about what we think the aims of education might be at every level. So I thought I would set out 4 basic accounts, overlapping to be sure, but nonetheless distinct from one another, about what people have thought and what people do think education is fundamentally about, what its fundamental aims are. And I want to suggest to you that a lot of the current criticism, a lot of the current worry, a lot of the current anxiety about education, teaching and learning, have to do with people's lack of clarity about which of these four basic accounts they hold to tacitly as being central to education, and their feeling that one or another or all four of those things are not being met leads them in turn to worry and fret over education. So let me just set out these four accounts as a kind of vocabulary, and then we can start talking together about our present ills. So, the first account would suggest that really what schooling ought to do, its fundamental aim is to provide skills and arts. Or better yet, instead of using the word provide, let's say to cultivate. To cultivate skills and arts. And we'll put one word on this, just so we can talk about it later economically. This is to understand education as somehow preparation. Okay, preparation for something else. A kind of empowerment. We want to locate under this heading battle cries like back to basics. The three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic. Okay, and that basically to construe education in an extended sense, all the way from elementary school through college and even the university, that we're basically in some sense attempting to cultivate in human beings those arts and skills which empower them then to learn what they need to learn about the world. Okay? So I'll put under here this back to basics business. It's a recurrent battle cry, the fear that somehow the basic arts and skills that human beings need are being lost in other agendas. I think I'll also list under this general heading, this term I put before about empowerment. Help fill that out a bit. And I want to say a little bit more about this before going to the second thing. One can construe reading and writing and arithmetic, each of those R's, very broadly. And I think the partisans of this view of education would want to do that. I tell my students when we start reading together and they're entering college that we're still going to be learning how to read. One never stops learning how to read. And I would argue that in the extended sense of reading, the geology hike that some will go on, or some are already on, with Mark Johnson up the valley, will be, in a way, learning to read a mountain valley. In other words, the text is nature, and what he's going to provide people with is the kind of experience together as a community, which will lead them all separately then to be able to look at mountain valleys and see new things there, read them in new ways. So one can, in other words, use reading as an extended metaphor to not only talk about reading words and texts, but reading social events and rituals, reading cultures, reading mountain valleys, reading the stars, etc. And under that extended sense, again, what one is doing is giving people the skill and the art whereby to do that on their own. Okay, so let's take that as number one. Number two would be to provide a common culture or vocabulary. And we will call this, when we call this preparation, we'll call this information. Partisans of this view go way back into history. We used to talk about a big movement in American social and cultural history called the creation of the common school The principle is that you have the educational system being designed so that all people within it are given a common body of information, of stuff, so that they then can converse profitably with one another in an extended democratic community. So that what you want to do is give them a common set of terms, a common set of facts, a common history, which you shape. In other words, you forge through the educational system a common wheel. Okay. Now, contemporary partisans of this view, some of you might have heard of, a man by the name of E.D. Hirsch, who's quite controversial, who wrote a book called Cultural Literacy, and who was even provided as a kind of addendum to that book, an extended addendum, a literal list of facts, places, names, dates, terms that every educated human being ought to know in this culture. He really believes that we're serving the common weal by providing this kind of cultural literacy, this common index of information, and so forth. This is the kind of thing where you'll get the implicit notion often that if you're really educated, if you've really been 4 years in college, come back, Uncle Ralph says, well, who won the Battle of Manassas? And you say, I don't know. And he says, and we spent thousands of dollars and you don't know who won the Battle of Manassas. You're just ignorant. So there's a whole kind of Cracker Barrel view of education, not again entirely misguided, that suggests there has to be certain stuff there in your head, which the schools are supposed to put there. Otherwise, you're not educated. Okay? This view obviously is the one now, if you read the journals or the newspaper, that's creating the greatest amount of social and cultural controversy, because some would say, look, to try to teach a common culture, a common index of terms or names or dates or places, is to really overlook the rich diversity of life that we have in our country and throughout the world. And we ought to really be about getting people to appreciate diversity rather than to imagine that someone, some group, some board of education, some national government has some monopoly on what it is that every educated human being ought to know. So as soon as you begin to suggest that education is finally information, massive controversies break out over what information, for whom, when, and who makes the decisions about what information we have. So lots of people who are upset about education, or who would answer what's wrong with it, would hone in on this and say that people are either not getting enough information or they're getting the wrong information. Okay? Three, another aim of education that has a long history and that still lingers here and there would be to shape character. And we might use, if we're going to have a one-word tag for number three, I'm going to make them all end in T-I-O-N, so they'll be easy to remember. We'll call this formation. Formation. You heard today's matins, and one of the quotes was something like this: sow a thought and you reap an act, sow an act and you reap a habit, sow a habit and you reap a character, sow a character and you reap a destiny. Partisans of this view of education would be very, very comfortable with that quotation, because the notion would be that what you're really shaping here in a deep sense through education are souls. Souls meaning the whole disposition of the human being to act in ways that are presumably noble and excellent. And so you're forming, literally, habits of inquiry, habits of how human beings relate to one another. So it becomes then second nature to them to be, let's say, generous, charitable, courageous, etc. And so what you're really doing in education, again, all the way from elementary through college, is formation, the forming of character. And that's much more important partisans of number three would say, than what kind of information a person gets. And number one would say, we don't care which information they get. You can hand them any book and teach them to read. We're a little indifferent about the makeup of the curriculum. We're just concerned that they have these arts and skills. But that's different from three, which is, what virtues do people have when they emerge? Are they courageous, generous, charitable, honest, diligent, industrious, etc.? Okay? So this has to do with virtues, this with arts and skills, this with stuff or facts. Okay? Here the question is, what kind of human beings do you want these persons to be once they finish 4 years at PLU? Here the question would be, what do you want all of these people to know? What kind of stuff once they finish 4 years at PLU? And here would be, what kind of arts and skills do you want them to have once they finish 4 years at PLU? Or fill in the blank. It can be so-and-so elementary school. Okay, number four would say, to stimulate creativity. So here we could go for lots of words ending in T-I-O-N, creation, imagination, reformation. The theme for the village this summer, as most of you know, is this Imago Dei, the image of God. And one of the most consistent and powerful accounts of what it means to be fashioned in the image of the Creator is to be invited into a process of being creators ourselves, co-creators. And so we have, especially in the 20th century, a great emphasis on the view of the human being as fundamentally creative, making the world, or remaking the world, or making the self, or remaking the self. So that, in other words, what education ought to be on this account is fundamentally the stimulation of those powers that are already within the human soul, which is, after all, fashioned in the image of the Creator, to call them forth, to give them discipline and direction so that human beings can make things. Books, cabinets, homes, bridges, themselves, societies, communities, whatever. This account of education really emphasizes that aspect of cultivating the individual. Okay, now, granted, if I were to ask any of you, what's your account of education, you would probably want to opt for some combination of these four. Probably nobody in here, although we'll soon find out, would want to say, well, education just this, or just this, or just this. Some would say, well, you know, in elementary grades, that'll be more, let's say, two, and high school more three and four. Pretty soon people would introduce distinctions and so forth. But the important thing to see, once we've said that they overlap, they're not mutually exclusive, and people in here are bound to say, look at some combination, is that when we worry individually or as a society about what's wrong with our schooling, it's very important to see, we're tacitly carrying with us, we're privileging, we're lifting up as most important and vital one of these four things. So some people will say, good grief, the kids in this community, we give them tests, they score the lowest on the reading achievement test, the lowest on the math achievement test. Kids in Seattle are way behind the kids in Chicago, or vice versa. We all fret about this because we tacitly think education's really about skills and arts. And if Johnny or Susie can't read at a certain level once they finish, it's time to wring our hands and fire the school superintendent and so forth, okay? So our model there, if we really think that low test scores, insofar as tests can measure aptitudes and skills, we're probably tacitly harboring this model as being crucial and these as being less important. Never mind whether Johnny and Susie, even though they might not be able to read in a way that can be measured by a test, might be very whole, happy, flourishing human beings. The fact is, we get nervous if they can't be tested on. Other people will say, good grief, we spent $80,000 to send so-and-so to Stanford. They took the achievement test in history. They scored a 20 on it. How could all this money have been worth a Stanford education or a PLU education or education at Valparaiso, where I'm not sure my students would score all that high, frankly, on the American History Achievement Test. And then we'd say, look, they don't have the right kind of knowledge. That can be tested. They did poorly. We worry. Other people say, look, this doesn't matter all that much, these two things. What really matters is what kind of human beings they are. And if they just come out with a lot of, the Greek word for some of this would be techne, tools, give them tools, and let them then go forth and do whatever they wish. If all they have is techne, what we've turned out are, in an extended sense of the term, technologists, people who know how to manipulate tools of various powerful sorts to do with nature and with each other what they wish, but never raise the question, what's worthy of wishing to do with nature and so forth. And that gets back into character. We would hope that human beings are those that have good judgment, a kind of compassion and sensitivity to the world and others, so that with these powerful tools they would do the right thing, or things that are worthy of human flourishing. And absent this, what you have are just specialists without spirit and sensualists without heart, if you just have techne. So obviously people are going to say some kind of combination. But what I want you to reflect on as we begin to talk is, where are your own centers of gravity? I mean, as you look at this chart and we're asked, and I might even ask you, at least to think about it, what is the crucial element up here? That if you could only do one thing you'd want to do, which one would that be? If you answer that question for yourself, in your own soul, you can probably then figure out just exactly why you're worried about education and what you find effective about it, because you bring to the conversation one or another or some combination of these things. Let me just add one footnote and then we'll talk. One could have put as a subset on three, and I didn't because here's my own bias, I suppose, something called inculcation. Because there's a lot of talk, has been for the last 20 years or so, everybody worrying about values and saying that what you ought to do when you go to school is to get values there. And so the vocabulary is often values clarification or values education, as though values are things that kind of float about and you can sort of give students the right values. I think that's a poorer term than character formation, because that suggests forming habits of ways of being in the world and instilling virtues rather than giving people values. I think values is a weaker term than virtue. There's a joke about what would it have been like if Moses had descended from Mount Sinai and said, here are the 10 values. Something kind of weak about the term values in that context, as opposed to what Moses actually did bring down, not the 10 values. So I think that this is a stronger account if one's oriented toward this view of education, the shaping of character, than the inculcation of values. And as soon as, of course, you talk about inculcating values, then, just like here, you get into massive controversy, because the next question is, of course, inculcate which values, who decides which values are worthy of inculcation, and what in the world could that mean, inculcating values. Okay, so I think what I've tried to do is give you a vocabulary, locate some of the arguments and criticisms that go on. I could give you further names and books, but I think that rather than to book drop, that's not terribly helpful. What's more helpful is to talk this over. So I guess I open the floor now for comments or questions of clarification. And if there are none of those, then I'll ask you some questions. So the floor is yours.
With the exception of maybe universities such as Valparaiso, it seems to me that most schools are in the business of preparation. Is that true? How do you see it?
One account would certainly be that if you read the addresses given by, say, the university presidents at their annual report to their boards of what are called the leading universities in this country. I try to read these annual reports. They would say that on this point, techne, the at least higher education in this country is without peer. In other words, when the world wants to send its best and brightest to research universities, they come here to learn techne. They want to teach them engineering, government, whatnot, how to do things. They come here. And so the reports on the research universities are kind of glowing in that way. They're simply abounding. They're getting richer and richer, more esteem and so forth because of this. There was just an article in the paper of this family, the Bass family, that's now given $25 million to Stanford after giving $80 million to Yale, and Yale was in line for another $25 million but didn't get it and all this. But the point is that those universities are in good shape, and they really are the envy of the world when it comes to techne. Okay? And so I think you're right. I think that one way you could, it's oversimplified, but I think one way that you could summarize fairly the history of higher learning in this country is it's been steadily a movement away from three, which in the 19th century was uniformly one of the central aims, and toward an exclusive concentration on one, on techne. And I think that explains a lot about some of our difficulties as a nation. Pure techne, but not the kind of wisdom, not the kind of generosity, charity, and so forth that would harness that techne for ends that really lead to human flourishing, not only for us as a people, but for the world as well. So I think that's quite right. Yes?
Using these 4 points, and as we look at education today, can we look at it as a situation where education, there's nothing wrong with it, as we look at these points, they may exist, all four of them, in a given situation, but the breakdown comes somewhere along the line when one or more of these things are not being accomplished. Number three, this is one that begins preschool. Mm-hmm. And if there's a breakdown preschool, then we're in trouble right away. And then as you go on up the line there, with all of these things maybe developing for some, three works out fine for some youngsters, and then there may be a breakdown in a given system on one of the others, and so there's a point where individuals, we say that education, there's something wrong with it. Here's an individual that fails at this point on your 4-point scale.
Responses to that? I don't want to conduct a lot of individual dialogues and have you listen in. Let's just pick up on the suggestion there that in a way there are other institutions, families, churches, and so forth involved in the process of formation and education, and that by the time students get to some of these schools, even an elementary school, their character is pretty well formed, or malformed, or deformed, or insufficiently formed, whatever, and that to ask of educational institutions to do all of those 4 things throughout is perhaps to place too much of a burden upon them and too onerous a set of expectations on them. You were going to say.
Well, that was pretty much what I was going to say, that education isn't just in a facility, in a building, by educated people, but I feel it's my responsibility as a parent is all to educate and to get them to churches or other things other than just the public school or private school I choose to send them to. And what bothers me is I see with particularly our society now getting so involved with both parents working outside the home, that a lot of that is being pushed into the public schools to say, well, you need to do this for my child because I don't have the time and energy.
Excellent point. If one look at education historically, there's a very important book written 20 years ago, very tiny one, called Education and the Formation of American Society by a historian named Bernard Bailyn. And he's looking at education in the 17th century. And what he's pointing out is this whole notion that education is equated to schooling, which in many minds it is, that we're more used to, is a rarity, not only in Western history, but in world history. And in the extended family, most of this formation, information, arts and skills, was done in the network of the extended family. It was only when you got down to the nuclear family that you had the rise in primary schools. Okay? In other words, even then, going back three centuries, step A is you get elementary schools because the extended family collapses into the nuclear family. So now schooling happens, and what you're saying is we're now in another phase with the nuclear family and both parents working. We're now turning over to other institutions, the formation of the little ones from practically the time they emerge from the womb. So that process, in other words, that you're citing is something that has roots very deep within our history. It didn't just start in 1960. It started in the colonial period.
A sad reality is, and it isn't for everyone, and maybe it's only a small part of our society, but do we just throw that part of our society away or whatever, is an example, the single mom who works 70 hours a week to keep things together. I've been there. There isn't. I mean, sometimes we make comments like it is the family's fault that they don't have time. But the reality is sometimes there just is not time.
Mm-hmm.
And what then?
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to speak to that. I think that's real valid, and I think that's for a community like we're sitting in right now, and hopefully we can take back to our communities, has that support. If you've had any contact with Indian tribes, a child on the street is everybody's child. And it would be nice if we could do that too.
Mm-hmm. The answer is, and it anticipates what I was going to say in my closing comments, but I'll just underscore it now and come back to it once we finish talking together. Communities of inquiry and formation are what we may really be missing. And a lot of the problems that people have already cited, which we're asking our educational system to address, in a way it's powerless to address because, in effect, we don't really have communities of learning and teaching. And your example of Holden is very right, it seems to me. In fact, I don't think what's most important about Holden Village and the experience here, whether it's for the staff or for the villagers, is necessarily what goes on in these classes, what happens to us this hour. It's the opportunity to converse afterwards. It's the framework in which we do have our children run about and everyone looks after them. It's that we can see close up how dependent we are on the folks who make the food, the folks who do the garbage, the folks who... We get a much clearer and profound sense, I certainly do when I'm doing dish team or sorting garbage, on how really interdependent a web we are and how much our lives are shot through with learning together. So I really think that's already getting us some distance to be getting to find out what solutions might be there for some of these difficulties.
Isn't that true for a home school system also? It's a part of society, and the children learn from society as much as from the school which they are in. So if they learn here in Holden Village certain things, they are in another setting and they learn from that setting, and it might not be school, but school reflects it and couldn't succeed easily if they learn one thing outside and another inside, and they see that it might not be true. they learn in ways that are not very clear, but they still learn. And therefore, we have problems, and if we don't take it as a hope, we might not be able to solve them.
Mm-hmm. Quite right. The discontinuity that often happens between the community and the school system, okay, that the school system allegedly serves, creates some of the most ardent and heated controversies we get locally and nationally in education. In other words, supposing you're into number three, 3A, inculcating values. Well, supposing the values being inculcated are not the values of the community as a whole, then you begin to see this adversarial relationship grow up between the school system, quote unquote, and the community, quote unquote, and a lot of angry PTA meetings and so forth, and school board people being fired and all of that. And I think one way to locate all of those controversies, and they differ from community to community, is to see them in a way as testimony to there being a discontinuity, a lack of harmony between the community and its own schooling. Yes.
There also seems to be a discontinuity between the school and the world as a whole. In other words, if we say we value human life and people, how do you square that with war?
Mm-hmm.
And the kids then are confused and are wondering, you know, what's true?
Good point. Good point. As soon as, for example, you, let's supposing a given community could agree, and some of them do, militantly agree on exactly what they want taught, to whom, when, what texts are to be read, what texts aren't, etc. Sometimes those communities become tribal entities and subscribe to certain values which are at odds with the larger world, so that they may have continuity between the immediate community and the school system, but massive discontinuity and conflict between what's being promulgated there. They decline into a kind of tribalism, and what the whole interdependent network of the world and our neighbors everywhere really are about. It's quite true. I think you had your hand up.
Yeah. Well, I think that there is a fear on the part of the parents and on the part of the educational system of each other, because each knows that they have their shortcomings and afraid of criticism. It's hard for them to work together because of fear of criticism.
That feeds back into the educational system itself. I mean, some educators believe that the most important obstacle to education is not ignorance, but fear. My last section is entitled The Courage to Know, Spirited Inquiry. And I think that it's not only that the school system and the parents are afraid of criticism, but I think that fear is something that is bred within them by the educational system, where people have been punished and humiliated for their ignorance, and then they're fearful to open up, to admit their ignorance as a basic fundamental assumption you have to have before you can learn anything. Yes?
It seems like it might be useful to look at your four segments there, and it's sort of like the body of Christ, because I think that while they're all important goals in education, I'm not sure that they are all important for everybody at the same time. Each person has a particular need, maybe at a certain stage in their life or a certain age. And the society has a need for certain kinds of people who are skilled in maybe only certain one or two of those areas. We don't have to have everybody good at all those things. And maybe people don't want to be creative. Maybe people don't want to be fantastic leaders. I think one of the problems that in our education society is that we're trying to do all those things, and in the end, we're not doing well at anything. I teach at a private school, and we do a very good job of two or three of those things, and probably not a very good job of a couple of other things, and we have parents that come up and say, well, you know, why don't you do this other thing? And we sort of have to say, well, you know, we do a very good job of these things. There's simply not time in the day to include those other things that you want. If you would like that and you feel it's important, you're going to have to go to some other place and get it. And I think that we can afford to say that in the public schools as well. That's why we have systems like magnet schools, you know, where there are certain emphases that you can latch onto, depending on what your needs are or your desires or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well said, and I think that that's another thing we might have said at the beginning, is the value of a pluralistic system of education, where there are many options with different emphases on these, so that people can make choices. Ideally, we would have a system whereby people had vouchers, that is, support, in order that they could register those choices and do what in their judgment is best for their young, because they can make judgments about that, probably better than a state bureaucracy, and send the young off to get whatever one of these is most needful to them at a given point in their development. Yes?
It occurs to me that there's another basic question that perhaps ought to be asked before we start asking how good is education. And that is the question is whether, to what extent we perceive education as being for the benefit of the specific student who is being educated, and how much we perceive it as being for the benefit of the community as a whole. You know, many of the comments on the current lack of education have pretty well been saying that the nation as a whole is going to be short on people with adequate skills to compete internationally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are many other things you can pick out there that are really for the benefit of the community as a whole, which of course is probably paying most of the bill for the schools. Other things you can point out is really for the benefit of the student himself, perhaps. I think they're both of these goals, which were important, just like all four of those goals were important. And perhaps we need to give some thought to how we balance these two things, just as we're giving thought to how to balance those four.
I think that's helpful. Do you have a secret thesis underneath that observation? That
no,
is,
I don't.
Do you think we've erred too much in the direction of either attempting to address what's good for the whole or what's good for the individual? You think the pendulum has swung too far in one direction? It doesn't have to be just you, anybody.
I don't know. I'd really like an answer to that.
Okay. Let's see if we can get some answers. Do you think that our... Yes.
Obviously, I'm relating back to my historic education process. One and two probably come to mind as being more important, and then three and four developed through people, grandparents, churches, and here.
So, but you think this gentleman would like to know whether...
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I missed your point. One and two, I think, are the benefit to the rest of the community. Certainly, they want me to be able to speak a language they can understand, have some common behavior, know what laws are, and, you know, respond to them and be productive. Some technical skill, don't be a leads to society. But I might miss an awful lot of four in how to enjoy that and get along with something I don't think is enough by the standards of one and two. The three and four will provide the difference. I don't know, is that...
We have another hand.
Yeah, in my position working with elementary school children, and I often work with children that are not learning easily or well, or they come from different cultures. And when I look at, think of my individual kids I've worked with, I look at them as what's good for them is going to be good for the society.
Yes.
Because if we can't get them going they're just going to be a weight on the society. And that's so fundamental. Either the cultural differences of working in a suburban school in Minnesota, basically white, but not anymore. And we're getting an amazing cultural diversity that we're going to have to really address to catch some of those kids. Because we're not going to catch them in the way I was brought up.
I guess that's what I was originally trying to say, that this has to be a starting point, because education will fail further along somewhere if we don't have those qualities.
And there's, I think, more and more demands for cultural diversity coming from the elementary grades and going on through as our society changes, as the Hmong people and the black people that are now having to deal in our very white society school and very successful school, standard test score wise, but suddenly we're changing. It's not just the city too.
You know, that's another thing in our schools that I think, especially inner city, you see more than perhaps before, is not only cultural diversity, but economic diversity. And you need to bring them all along to some point of being able to self-sustain themselves, or they are going to be society's burden too.
And working with very little children in first grade and kindergarten, another issue that's happening in my nice suburban school is the children that are affected chemically. Their mothers were using chemicals. And I don't know that we're equipped to really deal with what we're getting always. It's becoming an issue, I think.
Yes.
I teach high school dropouts as they decide to complete high school. And I'm looking at all of that and I'm thinking, you know, I like what she said about looking and addressing the economic diversity. And that's a cultural diversity issue too. And as we watched, you know, 35 of them graduate last week, it was real exciting to see that that is going to contribute to society as a whole and maybe ease some of the drain that people complain some about, as these people demand new services, which they're entitled to. It's a real thing. Then another issue I have too is I'm not sure that society is ready for empowering people. And if education, if we really educate empowerment, I don't think our institutions can handle questioning people.
In other words, if you add up under the arts and skills critical thinking, then you're not sure that the society...
It only goes so far, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that we in education are guilty of only taking it so far.
Mm-hmm.
How do you measure? How do you measure in our local, our governments? You know, they want measurements. And how do you measure beyond number two?
I think that's a problem.
That is the main
problem, think,
and
yes.
That just disturbs me terribly that
yes.
We are comparing and measuring our educational system through report cards.
Yes.
One school district to another school
yes.
district that have no equal basis whatsoever.
I quite agree. I think that the if it can't be measured, it isn't real.
Mm-hmm.
Is a real difficulty that we face on many levels, but especially with education, where we say, I'm getting these pressures all the time. As a dean, people say, well, now you're a dean of an honors college. How do your students do on the LSATs, the MCATs, and so forth? And we better be able to see a measurable difference here, otherwise you're not doing your job, and so forth. Parents come in and say, what good is it going to do my children to... Actually, I find the parents more pressing these young people into this kind of, if it can't be measured, it isn't real, then the young people themselves. Because they'll say, well, now, where do your students go to graduate school and law school as compared to the students at the rest of the university or other universities? Those kinds of questions get asked all the time. And I say, look, I'll be honest with you, the thing that makes me happy about being here is that we have as many of our students going into Lutheran Volunteer Corps, the Peace Corps, all kinds of volunteer organizations for a while. And often, I'm prouder of those students as I am about, and we do have plenty of them, who go straight from there to Harvard Law School or whatever. But the point is that what they all have in common, I hope, this is ideal, because I know the reality is not this, but is some sense of vocation. And by some sense of vocation, I mean, and here I'm getting to my wind-up, so that people poised for lunch can rest assured that we won't be here that much longer. My favorite motto is one by Bernard of Clairvaux. He said, some seek knowledge for the sake of knowledge. That is curiosity. Others seek knowledge that they may themselves be known. That is vanity. Still others seek knowledge so that they may enrich themselves. That is dishonorable. But there are some who seek knowledge that they may serve and edify others, and that is charity. And so I suppose I think, in a way, what I find missing, and that does incorporate a lot of these elements, is people's coming out of schools with a sense of vocation and an ethos of service. I mean, so that what they've learned, those technical skills that they've cultivated there, that information that they have, is directed toward the common good, which it seems to me is not going to be something that we're going to do through lectures or handing them the right books, but it's going to have to be something that we do in the way we treat them and get them to treat one another in the very process of education. In other words, it's in a way this man's point again. It's the whole life at, let's say, a Holden Village that educates and shapes, not just, or not even mainly, what's gone on this hour or what will go on in subsequent hours and so forth. And it seems to me that unless we kind of have a restoration of communities of learning, and I think the body of Christ metaphor that was introduced here is also very good, many members but with different gifts, and learning to sort of hold up and celebrate and recognize and learn that we all have to rely on that diversity of gifts, I think we're going to be in grave difficulties, not simply as a country, but as a world. I'll close with one anecdote to illustrate and give some concrete nature to this general comment. One of the things that we did in the honors program, which kind of was our effort to recognize programmatically what I've said abstractly here, is that when the 65 students come in, we give them they spend half of their course load with us the whole first year, and they do a lot of reading and a lot of writing, a lot of analysis and critical thinking and so forth. But we introduced in the first semester, we made all 65 of them work with the director of theater, and what they have to do as a group is to write and produce and perform their own musical production based on a theme in the course. They don't know each other at all. They have to find out who can write music, who can play music, who can do set design, who can design costumes, who can act, who can sing. They quickly find out, you know, I can't sing, but I'm certainly glad somebody here can. I can't write music, but I play a pretty mean clarinet. So pretty soon the whole sort of idea of learning and creativity as a corporate endeavor sinks home, not because the dean gave them some spirited lecture, but because in 10 weeks of hard work, they get something that they perform for the rest of the college that they're proud of. That was good because, as in an orchestra, all of them were good and excellent at what they did, and they pushed each other to realize their best. And the point is that that kind of activity, when those alums come back, which they do, and what do they remember? Not Thucydides or even King Lear or Encebe or Gabriel Garcia Marquez or any number of the authors. They remember those some, but they know the theme of their freshman production. They can all sing it. and which shows that it was sort of that aspect of a common life in which they learned a lot about each other that kind of created a community that made the rest of the teaching through collaboration. Because it seems to me that collaboration and conflict become possible only in community. Competition's the enemy of community, not conflict. And that's what, it seems to me, gets those, there are other devices in which you can do this, those students to flourish. That little device, which was, I can't claim credit for it, it was already in place when I came, was one of the reasons I was interested in coming there. But there are other, myriad of other things one can do that. But I mean, I think it gets at this point of how you instill virtues and so forth. It's through sharing a common life together, not through books, lectures, and inculcation. And absent that, I don't really think, and this is what I'll be talking about in subsequent times, absent that kind of thing, I don't really think one can do any of these things very well. And what I want to try to show in some subsequent times together is why that's so. One more comment?
What you're talking about or what's happening here at Holden is, you know, communal or sense of community. But I think in the real world, rather than moving toward that, we're moving further away from that. People are on the move, they don't make roots, they don't, families are not extended anymore. So we're moving further and further away from that. And I think everybody's, a loser because of that. But.
Mm-hmm. Bill.
I need to make one comment before you close, Mark. My name is Bill Strelo, and I'm to serve as the village philosopher here for the next week, actually 2 weeks. And by way of introduction, I explain what I envision that to be as we move further into the week here at Holden, and as we get into some what I'm calling uncharted waters, some conflicts, some feelings, some ideas that may or may not be new to us. I encourage you to find a way to either seek me out or as individuals or as a group, so that we can talk about some of these uncharted waters and find our ways through them, so we don't find ourselves drawing away from each other as happens in the real world, but as some of these conflicts that may come upon us as we learn some things together, we may find a way to talk about them together. And those can take place in small groups outside of these sessions. So you're invited just to seek me out.
Thanks, Bill. And thank all of you, and have a good day.